Just in case anybody needs to get me with very low volume. Okay. All right. Well, welcome everybody. So I just want to say, we're going to talk about this at the end of class, but the vote is unanimous to have a break of those who have weighed in. Other opinions can certainly still be heard a little bit later, but I think we are going to have a break, partly because I need one. I think it'll refresh us all, frankly, because I feel like this is week 20, as I said before, some people joined us. We're in week 20, and sometimes it's good to let things settle a bit. So this will be kind of like the meditation break. You know, this is where we let everything settle. And we'll talk more about how to keep it fresh at the end. But if you like the Two Wings of Awakening meditation, everybody has received it in email form. So you can continue that, you know, you can do that on your own if you don't already. It's a good format of like a really complete meditation with both ultimate bodhicitta or nature of mind and relative bodhicitta, love and compassion. And as you've seen over the weeks, you can choose any focus. There's just infinite number of ways to focus on it, from our own pain to the pain of public and political figures to the pain of the entire universe, to working with people that we personally really find difficult. You can just mix and match it all the time. So I'm going to, does anybody have anything they want to say before we go further? So we're on verse 15 this week. I think today we'll look at the commentaries first. I did, I was very late getting the verse and the contemplation up on the website today because I just had a really busy week getting back from Texas. But there was a contemplation, and if you didn't have a chance to see it yet, we'll spend some time on that, on discussion of that at the end. In fact, I'm going to maybe read the contemplation. It'll take me a second to bring that up. I'll read the contemplation. And we can have that in the back of our mind as we go through the commentaries. And again, if anybody has anything they want to say, feel free to unmute or wave your arms. Waiting for it to load on my phone. All right, here's the contemplation for today. So again, the verse, if someone tells a crowd my hidden faults, I mean, this is like public exposure. You know, it's different from verses, like each verse is a different take. And these first four, this is the fourth of the sets of eight worldly concerns. So this is the last set of worldly concerns. This one's different from the previous two. Like in the first three, we didn't do anything wrong. If someone steals all your stuff, well, you didn't do anything wrong. Maybe you forgot to lock your door or your car, but you know, that's not a big fault. That's just a lapse. Somebody did something to you that was not deserved, except maybe karmically, which is where we go. First place we always go is karmically, everything is deserved in some way. Second one is about make sure I get them in the right order. Okay, verse 13 is, if you haven't done anything wrong and someone cuts off your head, like you're totally attacked and you didn't do anything. Third one, if someone slanders you, right? If someone slanders me and spreads the word maligning me throughout the universe. So again, you didn't do anything. Like it's something like it's unjust. It's injustice. You didn't do anything and someone is saying you did. And we talked about the possibility of not reacting to that, you know, besides repaying it with love and compassion, which is what we're instructed to do. Some teachers actually suggest we could actually just take the blame, as some great teachers have done in the past over very serious things. Just let people think we did it. We don't even have to defend ourselves. That's a judgment call from situation to situation, but it's a possibility. But this one's different. Verse 15 is different. If someone tells a crowd my hidden faults, like I have them. I did the thing. I have the fault. I did the thing. But I don't want anybody to know about it. We probably all can relate to that in some way. We do something or did something that, like, God forbid anybody should ever know that about me. But somebody does find out, and somebody, like, blasts it out on Twitter and speaks of me with undisguised contempt. I mean, the news is full of that right now. We are full of contempt for people who have done certain kinds of, you know, actions towards other people. Where are those people and what are they feeling? We know what it feels like. So compassion can come from that we know what that would feel like. But we did the wrong thing. So the antidote here, to see them as my spiritual friend and bow to them sincerely with respect. Well, in fact, as the commentaries are going to bring out, they're acting as your teacher. They literally are, because that is the role of the teacher, is to mirror back to you where you're not getting it right. So somebody's doing that on steroids and you're totally crushed and shamed. So this one's different. We did it. And that brings up a whole different possibility for contemplation here, because we can all think of something. I don't know if that's true. I apologize if it's not true for anybody. I don't mean to malign anyone. I know for me, there's certainly things in my past, maybe even in my present, that I just assume, you know, people didn't know about me. And that is the definition of hypocrisy, right? You know, we don't think of ourselves as hypocrites, but that's hypocrisy, is when you want your public face and your private face are different faces. So for some of us, maybe it's on a small scale, you know, and then, you know, you eat the gallon of ice cream every night. And for some people, maybe it's some really bad thing. So how do we deal with that? So here's the contemplations. And there's a couple, there's like three different contemplations here. And I'm just going to say what they are. And we won't talk about them yet because I want to look at the commentaries first today. So the first one is, so think of a time when this happened to you. And we can do this internally. Unlike practice 14, in this case, you are being blamed for something you actually did and or faults you actually have. Your tormentor is just making public what you had hoped to keep hidden. How did you respond at the time? Like, what was your response if your faults were exposed? And how do you feel about it now? So obviously we don't have time to go, you know, for everybody to do a lot of soul searching right now, but this is a contemplation you can do anytime. I'm just bringing this out for purposes of discussion in a bit. So that's one contemplation. Like, did it happen to you in the past? How did you handle it? How does it feel now? Second contemplation is taking it to the next level. Is there some behavioral pattern or shameful deed in your past or your present that no one knows about and that you would be humiliated to acknowledge? Is there anything you don't want people to know about you, or is your life really an open book? So if there is, what would you do if someone called you out for it? If somebody found out and told everybody? Put it on Facebook, put it on Twitter, called the New York Times. Would you deny it? Like, would your first impulse be to deny it? Like, maybe you could get away with that, saying you didn't do it. I can think of some famous examples where that was done and didn't work out in the end. And if you deny it, then what? What are you left with? How does that feel? What would happen if you owned up to it? So these are all things we can think about. Would you be able to respond in the way Tokmei Zanpo advises? And how might you increase the odds that you could respond this way if it were to happen in the future? Like, what can we do to reinforce ourselves so that if out of the blue, totally unexpectedly, somebody, you know, tweets our worst fault, our worst behavior, our most shameful secret, how can we prepare ourselves for that? Because even if that specific thing doesn't happen, something will. That will require us to be very mindful and remember our bodhisattva training. And here's the third contemplation is, if no one ever knows about it but you, it doesn't get exposed. Is there a way to deal with it constructively and diminish the karmic repercussions now through your practice? What can we do about it now without it being exposed? Is that helpful? And what specific practices are available for this? So we're going to come back to this at the end, and we'll chat about it, and people can share their thoughts. And meanwhile, we have one silent pop quiz that I also posted, and it's a very useful silent pop quiz. And if you read Dingo Chente's commentary in particular, because he's the one who brings this out for each of these verses, you probably do know which of the eight worldly concerns are at play in this verse. So the eight worldly concerns are four sets of two opposites. Can you name all eight? What are the eight worldly concerns? I see a few people seem to have a good idea. And if you can't, then there's a link to the mnemonic device, which is tuned to row, row, row your boat. I'm going to actually sing it, but I'm going to look at the words because I'll forget. Even though I do know it, I swear I know it. So to the tune of row, row, row your boat, I could put it up, but I don't think I will. Loss, gain, pleasure. Oh, is that the right tune? Loss, gain, pleasure, pain, praise or blame, disgrace or fame. When your mind is tame, they're all the same. This is the Dharma practitioner's aim. So that's how you can learn the eight worldly concerns and just have them at a snap. So which one is this? Is this loss versus gain? Is this, that actually is verse 12. That one's really obvious. Somebody steals all your stuff, you lost everything. Pleasure, pain. I think that applies to all of them. So, and that one's a little tricky in this particular context. Praise or blame, disgrace or fame. So the last two sets, I think it's, you could apply almost to both of them. This one is specifically disgrace. Is praise or blame. Your fault is exposed and you get blamed instead of praised. But I think you could make a case for disgrace or fame here too, although Dingo Chense assigns disgrace or fame to the previous verse. All right, anyway, that's just a little public service announcement about the importance of knowing the eight worldly concerns, because that is our measure of how far we have to go on the path, is how much we're invested in whether we lose or win, whether at any given moment we're feeling comfortable or uncomfortable, pleasure or pain, how much it bothers us when we're blamed for something or criticized, and how much we puff up when we're praised, and how much we care about our reputation, whether people know about us or don't know about us, and if they do know about us, whether they think we're great or whether they think we're not great. So that's the eight worldly concerns, and very key to Dharma practice, the Dharma path. Hi, Namdak. Good to see you. All right, so we're looking at the commentaries now, and we're going to start with Dingo Chense Rinpoche. And in fact, that's the main one we're going to look at today. Ken MacLeod is always great, but I didn't find his chapter on this one like the most helpful one that I've read. I don't know how Kathy feels about that, because I know she loves that commentary. We will look at it a little bit, because there are some pithy comments in it. But I mean, I'm going to like, ooh, could I? You don't think it's the greatest one either? Well, it's very, I think there's a reason why. It's not, and I don't know if other people know Ken MacLeod's deep, dark secret, but there's a reason, I think, why that is not the most successful chapter in his book. And I will say why, but we're going to start with Dingo Chense and leave everyone in suspense. So we're on page 123. Oh, 123, I love when we get to a page like 123. Verse 15, and these are all fairly short commentaries. This is another really pithy one, has a lot of things that you could pull out and study separately. If you want to be a genuine follower of the Buddha, never retaliate when you are harmed. This is right up there in the hall of fame of like Buddhist mottos. Never retaliate. So clear. It's like thou shalt not kill. You know, I still remember the Onion's headline after 9/11. Like, what part of thou shalt not kill did you not get? So simple and pithy. Never retaliate. And it's just like the Buddhist the Buddha's teaching on anger, it's never helpful. We may not be able to help it. And sometimes it may push us to do like a good thing, but the anger itself, the emotion, never helpful. And never retaliate. We can tattoo that one too, or put that in the Hall of Fame. Very clear guideline. And so then he fills that out with a set of four principles of positive training that I've personally never heard of before. This may be something that's more Nyingma thing. But it's wonderful. It's, again, such clear guidelines. It's number one of the four principles of positive training. If someone abuses you, do not abuse him or her in return. Do not return abuse for abuse. Number two, if someone gets angry with you, do not get angry with him or her in return. Number three, if someone exposes your hidden faults, do not expose his or hers in return. And that's our present verse. That would be our first impulse, right? Like, but what about that thing you did? And it may be perfectly valid, but for a bodhisattva, it's a no-no. And number four, if someone strikes you, like this is physical violence here, do not strike them back. That could be really hard, and I think we could forgive ourselves if someone started beating on us and we were lashing out to it. We might not be able to help that. But these are the guidelines. Gosh, I love these because, again, they're just so clear. We don't, like, as bodhisattvas, Shantideva puts it really well in the Way of the Bodhisattva, or Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. He recommends becoming like a stick of wood. If you're a bodhisattva and somebody's hurting you, you become a stick of wood, meaning that you don't return it, you don't react in the moment. You just, shutting down is actually not a bad thing to do at that moment, unless you have to prevent some kind of harm from happening. If it's just you, and just especially if it's just your ego being hurt, Shantideva says be a stick of wood. And then you, that gives you like that moment, that's like counting to 10, gives you that moment to bring your, like, what am I supposed to do? Like, what did the Buddha say to do in this situation? Somebody just hit me, you know. So it's not that you let them keep hitting you, though. And again, we have to keep saying this, because that's how we take this advice sometimes. It sounds very literal. It doesn't mean we let them just keep hitting us, although Jesus said, turn the other cheek, right? So, you know, sometimes literally we can't do that. We could get out of the line of fire, though, if we need to. I think that's perfectly acceptable, is just find some nonviolent alternative way of protecting yourself if you need to. So the main point here, never retaliate. Whatever kind of harm it is, never retaliate, never lash out. So now he's going to get into details. If someone criticizes you, picking on your most sensitive points, or angrily insults you with the most offensive language, do not return like for like, no matter how difficult it is to bear. So he's acknowledging that this is not easy, that this could cause us a lot of suffering. Why does it cause us suffering? Because we still have ego in the game. That's a sign. And this is like back to the worldly concerns. This is pain versus pleasure. Someone criticizes us or insults us. That's we want to be comfortable. We don't want this pain. But Dingo Chense here says we need to accept that pain. This is the whole point of taking and sending, is like the bad thing happens, the unpleasantness. We're stuck in the unpleasantness and we breathe it in. We don't, unless, you know, we absolutely have to, don't run away from it. We learn to be able to contain it. But especially we don't do the same thing to the other person. There's no eye for an eye. It's, you know, same old advice, eye for an eye, no, not the way to go. So practice patience and never give way to anger. Take it positively and use it as a chance to let go of your own pride. Especially with this verse, like we really did the thing, we really have the fault. So it punctures our pride. That's why it hurts so much. it punctures our sense of, you know, ourself, like this great person we think we are, and suddenly maybe we have to acknowledge we weren't quite as great as we thought. But that's, pride is one of the poisons. It's one of the six poisons. So anything that diminishes our pride is a favor to us. So not only do we practice patience and never give way to anger, like that's the avoiding the negative, refraining from harm. That's verse 8. But on the positive side, we use it as an opportunity. And that's the whole Buddhist path. You're dying? Great. You have the best opportunity to become enlightened, like right in front of you. So look at the positive side. Avoid the negative side. Look at the positive side. And then he says, allowing others to win is a characteristic of all Buddhist paths. Oh, wait. Practice generosity and compassion as part of this by giving the victory to others and being happy to lose. Allowing others to win is a characteristic of all Buddhist paths. In fact, okay, so that's, you know, remember like all victory to others, give all victories to others, take all loss for myself. That's from Longri Tangpa. That's the Galugpa mind training. Very good motto to have in mind. All victory. And there's so many situations in life where we could do that. Like it's not taking anything away from us to give the other person the last word. But we can't do it. So that's our frontier for practice. Let somebody else have the last word. Even if we're right, we know we're right. Just let them have it. That's a small like arena for practice so that when the big arena comes and we get blamed for something we didn't do, we can just let it slide off. That's the sort of relative way to work for it with it. But he says, in fact, what is there to be won or lost? From an absolute viewpoint, there is not the slightest difference between winning and losing. So ultimately, nothing happening, right? There's no one giving the insult, no one receiving the insult, and no insult traveling, no insult existing. That is emptiness. That is the wisdom paramita. So then he talks about the, you know, like Tibetan teachers, they know whereof they speak in these situations because they've been through it. Like this generation that we have with us now, they've been through this exact thing. Many Buddhist teachers were abused, treated as criminals, and beaten when the Chinese communists came to Tibet. I mean, they were put in prison and tortured within an inch of their lives. Horrible things happened to them. Instead of feeling hatred, they prayed that the negative actions of all beings would be purified through the vindictive attacks against them. So we can take them as an example. And Dingo Chensei says, like them, when you are insulted and humiliated, hopefully never tortured, pray that using the connection you have established with those insulting you, you may be able to bring them all to liberation. And that's one of the aspirations that we make. One of the traditional classic aspirations is that may I benefit all beings who have any connection with me, good or bad. So, you know, people that we love, they're our family, whatever, and people that hurt us in some way, that we have a negative connection with. Our teacher flunked us. I can't think they put us in prison and tortured us. That's a bad connection. May we benefit them as well. So he just lays it all out here. There should be no insult or humiliation that is too great for you to bear. So Pema Chodron, in one of her teachings, you know, it's very funny. You know how she can be self-deprecating, saying pretty much this same thing, but saying that when you're caught up in the moment and speaking from her own experience, you think, no, this is a situation where I have to retaliate. This one's the exception. This is so bad that I just have to do something. I have to, you know, this is the one, but it's never the one. He says it's never the one. There should be no insult or humiliation that is too great for you to bear. Whatever it is that's happening, we're not off the hook. We have to be a bodhisattva in that situation, every single situation. There are no exceptions. If you were ever to feel it was justifiable to respond vindictively, okay, so that's the same territory. If you were to feel that it was justifiable, the exchange of bitter words and recriminations that ensue would be bound to inflame and escalate the anger on both sides. And isn't that true? Like we get the satisfaction of, you know, insulting them back, but then it just keeps going. Like, somebody has to stop it. Somebody has to stop the cycle at some point, and it needs to be us because we're the bodhisattva. This is how people start to fight and kill each other. Murders and wars all begin with just one angry thought. As Shantideva says, no evil is there similar to anger, or I think he means equal to anger. I don't think that's the right translation. No evil is there equal to anger, no austerity to be compared with patience. I might be wrong about the bad translation, but I think it's, anyway. No evil is there similar to anger, no austerity to be compared with patience. Actually, a teacher that I studied with, a Western teacher back in the 80s, used to say, and he'd spent a lot of time in India, he used to say, you know, forget the bed of nails. The greatest, not austerity, what's that called when you lie on a bed of nails? Anyway, we'll call it austerity for now. It's something else. But the greatest austerity is to keep your patience when somebody's pushing your buttons. That's asceticism, right? Asceticism is like when you put your body through hardships to show your equanimity. Like, you develop equanimity by lying on the bed of nails. Like, yes, it really hurts, but I am not going to respond to it. But he says, forget it. You don't need a bed of nails. Like, somebody's pushing our buttons all the time, and to not respond to that that's asceticism. So again, he's, you know, just hammers it in. Never give way to anger, therefore. Be patient, and moreover, be grateful to someone who humiliates you, as they are giving you a precious opportunity to strengthen your understanding and practice of bodhicitta. I don't think I have to hammer this in any more than Dingo Chenzi is. Not only do we refrain from harm, again, not only do we develop our patience, but we actually send them gratitude from our heart. And actually, one of them, maybe Dingo Chenzi, there's some place in one of the commentaries where it's really pointed out that this is exact, I think it's Ken McLeod, this is exactly what our teacher does for us. Our teacher tests us in every way possible. And so people who test us, who are not our teacher, they really become our teachers too. Because then it illuminates for us completely clearly how entrenched we are in the eight worldly concerns. And you can even pick which one it is that's happening at any given moment if you know them. So the great Jigme Lingpa said, and he was a great Nyingma teacher, ill treatment by opponents is a catalyst for your meditation. Insulting reproaches you don't deserve spur your practice onward. Those who do you harm are teachers, challenging your attachment and aversion. How could you ever repay their kindness? Indeed, you are unlikely to make much spiritual progress if you lack the courage to face your own hidden faults. Any person or situation that helps you to see those faults, however uncomfortable and humiliating it may be, is doing you a great service. As Lord Atisha says, the best spiritual friend is one who attacks your hidden faults. The best instructions are the ones that hit your hidden faults. The best incentives are enemies, obstacles, and the sufferings of illness. These are the things that give us something to practice with. The Kadampa master Shawopa used to warn his disciples as they came to see him, saying, I only show people their hidden defects. If you can avoid getting annoyed, stay. But if not, go away. So of the eight ordinary concerns, I like ordinary concerns, actually, the eight ordinary concerns. Therefore, even from the relative point of view, there are many ways of eliminating the distinction between the good and the bad, the ones you want to happen and the ones you do not. So again, each pair is one thing you want and one thing you don't want. So we're developing equanimity so that we don't care. From the point of view of absolute truth, there is not the slightest difference between gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disgrace, praise and disparagement. They are all equal and they are all empty by nature. As Shantideva says, to close out the commentary, thus with things devoid of true existence, so let's just take in the meaning of every word here. Thus, with things devoid of true existence, meaning like all things, everything that happens to us, no true existence to it. What is there to gain and what to lose? Who is there to pay me court and honors, and who is there to scorn and to revile me? Pain and pleasure, whence do these arise, and what is there to give me joy and sorrow? So that's Dinkochensi's commentary. Anybody have anything they'd like to say before I briefly look at Geshe Jean Patek-Chok's commentary? Yes, Marilyn. I'm going to try to unmute you. Yes, it worked.
Okay, I just wanted to say that recently there was an article, probably in the health section, I'm not sure, of the Washington Post, and it was proving or showing that revenge is a very bad it's very bad for your mental state. So the people are now saying that.
Yes, it's validated. I mean, I didn't see that article. I'm happy that it exists. Yes, validation from all points of view, all directions. It's actually bad for us. High blood pressure, bad for your health. And some of the commentaries bring that out too, although I can't bring to mind which one I'm thinking of. Oh, yes, Angela.
Well, one of the recent things when I've been practicing, I'm not sure even where I heard it from, but it's helped me a lot, is when I feel the pain that dropped the story.
Yeah.
I can feel it and it hits, and then I just drop the story behind it, and then I'm allowed not to have all that build up. So yeah. It helps a lot with that.
Very good advice. Pema Chodron talks about that, dropping she calls it the storyline. But yeah, that helps because that's what feeds the emotion to get stronger and stronger. Okay, thanks for that. Anybody else? All right, we'll briefly look at Geshe Jean Patek-Chok, and we're going to very briefly look at Ken McLeod, and then we'll have some discussion and then we'll wrap up about 20 after by talking about the hiatus. So this chapter called Transforming Blame into the Path. So again, it's that pair of praise and blame. Oh no, that's 14, 15. Transforming Criticism into the Path, same thing. All right. I'm just going to pick out a couple of things. He says, sometimes, this is how it's a favor to us when someone points out our faults. Sometimes we do not recognize our faults and may even think we are wonderful because of them. We may think our faults are actually good qualities and we need someone to point out to us that they're not, that maybe they cause suffering to other people and we're not even aware of that. He says, in this case, if someone points out our faults in front of a large group of people, it may be unpleasant to hear, but in the long term, it is very helpful to us. And one of the things Lama Norla used to say that I found extremely helpful is that if one person criticizes you for something, you can ignore it. But if everybody's telling you the same thing, you better pay attention. Sometimes people really don't recognize that something is a problem, and that could be me. Okay, so to avoid becoming angry when we are criticized or blamed, we can also think that not everyone on the planet criticizes us. This is a way to calm our mind down because in the moment, we're very emotionally reactive. So this is just like a placeholder almost. This is a way to soften it up so that we don't have to react, give ourselves time. We could think not everybody's criticizing us, just this one person. And there are people who have nice things to say about us. We don't need to get angry and be offended by what this person says because they're just one person. Other people feel differently about us. That could actually be a very useful tool just, again, for pacifying our emotional reaction. But, the hook here is similarly, when others praise us, instead of getting puffed up, we should think that not everyone says nice things about us. Some people say awful things, so there is no reason to be proud. So we could use that. He says, this can help us remain more emotionally balanced without reacting so much to either praise or blame. So whatever emotional reaction we're having, we could think of the other, we could think of the other side. Somebody's blaming us. We think, well, some people think I'm nice, and that makes us feel better. Somebody's praising us. We could think, well, not everybody thinks I'm that great. And that keeps us from getting our ego all, reinforced. He says, these are conventional ways to cut our anger and pride, meaning relative bodhicitta, relative reality. But on the ultimate level, just as Dingo Chensi pointed out, we should think that the words, like somebody's yelling at us, insulting us, criticizing us, broadcasting our faults, we should think that the words are mere designations and do not exist from their own side at all. Like, in what way do those words actually exist? And a really good, I can't remember where I heard this, but a really good way to, that you could maybe bring that to mind is think that someone's speaking to you in a foreign language. Like, somebody could be criticizing you up and down in, like, Swahili or, you know, Greek, and you wouldn't be bothered at all. They could be saying the worst things and exposing every hidden fault you have, and you wouldn't affect you in the slightest. So hear it as a foreign language. Or Mingyur Rinpoche says the same thing. He says that, you know, the meditation we do on sound, the shamatha we do with sound as the object, where we just sit and we notice all sounds. Mingyur Rinpoche says that one reason that we do that is so that when somebody's yelling at us, we can hear it as just sound. So you could scale it back to that level. You really could do that. Just sounds coming in, and they have no meaning to them at all. So we're going to take a very quick look at Ken MacLeod. And I will just say, you know, he starts off the same way he did so effectively, I think, in the previous chapter. See yourself in this situation. And he really builds it up. You made a mistake. You know you made a mistake, and you were struggling to come to terms with it. You have apologized. You have done your best, et cetera, et cetera. A few people discover what happened and are now taking you to task publicly. They demand that you be held. So he goes on and on and on with this. And, you know, again, we can relate to it, but he, you know, he had his own sex scandal, you know, back in like 2012. You can look it up, in the cloud scandal. There's some kind of ugly stuff out there about him too. I mean, I think nobody's enlightened. So I really felt that when I was reading this. This is probably maybe the experience that this came out of. And actually there's more than one incident, like more than one person. So, anyway, but as always, like, his antidote is, and he just says it explicitly, move into taking and sending. Like, you feel like crap. He makes you really feel like crap, like what this would feel like. And he says, just move into taking and sending. That is, like, verse 11, that is the tool for every situation. You can't think of what you're supposed to do. Just start breathing in the bad stuff. Are you just stretching there, Kathy, or did you want to speak?
Yeah, no, I'm good.
Okay, good to hear your voice anyway for a second. All right, taking and sending. All right, so then he says later on, this is something I was just listening to a teaching by Pema Chodron, and she made this point a lot. She makes this point a lot, and the Dalai Lama does, that we can have compassion for other people because we know what things feel like ourselves. So he says a positive aspect of having somebody destroy you in this way, basically, is, he says, you see that the humiliation that you feel is exactly the same as the humiliation other people feel who have been humiliated. And the humiliation they feel is exactly the same as the humiliation you feel. So it can make your heart go out when somebody else's faults are exposed and you're tempted to jump on the bandwagon and tweet some nasty thing or, you know, pile onto them. You could remember what it feels like because you've experienced it. You know what it feels like. And whether it's right or wrong, in this case it's right, like they really did the thing, you can still have compassion for them because you know how bad it feels and you know what kind of karma they're accumulating. Okay, and he says, the other thing he says that I found helpful, I thought there was one more, but anyway, we'll just go with this, is towards the end. He says an unhealthy form of shame. So here we're coming to terms with shame and trying to deal with it in a positive way from various points of view. Another unhealthy form of shame is insistent, relentless self-blaming. So in all of these verses, we don't descend into self-criticism and guilt. That's never helpful. It is helpful to acknowledge mentally that you did something bad, but we don't pile onto ourselves any more than we pile onto another person. And that brings us to the last part of the contemplation. Like, what if you have discovered like some fault that nobody knows about, and it would be humiliating to have people know about, like you did some bad thing or you have some bad habitual pattern. How can we deal with that without having the great good fortune of somebody expose it publicly? Like, can we work with it privately? And should we do that? So I'm going to actually unmute everybody now. You're all unmuted. We do have tools to work with that. Does anybody remember what they are? Like, what if you did remember a horrible thing you did? What could you do?
Regret. Regret.
I'm sorry? I'm not sure who spoke.
I said regret.
Richard, yeah.
It's the four R's, right?
Yes, yes, the four R's, the four powers, the four, what do they call them? The four something powers.
Remedies.
Yeah, yeah, it's in the Dorje Sempa chapter of Torch of Certainty, and you can find it in other places, the whole sequence. First, you acknowledge and regret it. Recognize and regret, that's step one. Second is to resolve never to do it again. Third one is to remember refuge. Like, supported by the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's like you're not alone in this. And the fourth, really important one, is remedy. And remedy can cover a lot of things. The Tibetans, like, the texts don't really so much cover making amends, but I think that's part of it. Like, if you can fix the situation now, like, maybe you should do it. And if you can't fix it, maybe the person you hurt has died, or it just wouldn't help to get in touch with them or whatever. You do Dorje Sempa. You do whatever practices you have for purifying the karma. You say mantras. You could even say, Om Mani Padme Hum for the person. And through that, the benefit of doing that is that you're chipping away at the karma of this. The karma gets bigger and bigger the more it's unacknowledged. And so that's the favor that someone's doing by exposing us, is that by us recognizing it and feeling humiliated by it, the karma doesn't get so big. Like, we're experiencing the suffering now. We don't have to, like, have it amped up in the next life. And it also, I mean, our own mind is like shaken or darkened by knowing these things about ourselves. And this is the way to bring them to light within our own mind. You can bring it to light and you can expose it in your own mind. And then there's the other steps, the remedies. So if you don't know those steps by heart, I suggest reading that chapter, Dorje Sempa or Vajrasattva in the Torch of Certainty, or anywhere else. You get the four, just opponent powers, the four opponent powers is what they're called. Where's Angela?
They're also in the new tricycle this month.
I'm sorry, it's in tricycle?
Tricycle this month. This new quarter for the magazine came out, and it's also in there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, Lama Norla was also mentioned in there.
Yeah.
And I think it's good to also use your faults to help other people when they're feeling. It helps you connect to them on a way to a level that you can say, I've done this too, and it can be changed.
Yeah.
On the way out. So I've been sort of exposed to number 15 quite a lot. I'd said my mom's the embodiment of 15 because she's great that out there. And so I've always done that to go.
She's the criticizer?
Yes.
Yeah.
So even between me and her, I used to criticize her back before I learned the Dharma. And then it was like, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. And then it's turned to, well, I've changed. Yes, this has happened. But now these things are happening. These are my improvements. And this is it for everybody. It's not just me.
Is it having a good result in that relationship? Can you tell?
I live with her, so it's kind of easier to deal with that on a daily basis. Kids are around, and so she doesn't spin, and I'm like, but she can change, and everybody can change, and I'm also a health coach, so that's just something you can, and the Dharma has given me great ways to incorporate that.
That's great. Yeah, because it stops the cycle. You know, the cycle depends on you reacting in a certain way, and that feeds the whole momentum or dynamic of it. And so when one person stops the thing, it's like, where can it go? And it will re-arise. I mean, it will re-arise. It's not dead, but.
Well, she would get stuck right into where, you know, you did this, you did that all the time. And it's good to be able to express, yes, but now I don't do that, or they have to do that, or we're working towards a different.
Yeah.
And it's important to kind of also not get stuck in being. Yeah.
Okay, anybody else have anything they would like to share or say related to this? Yes, Deidre.
Yeah, to me, like, humor helps too. Like, because when Peter and I were raising his son, we would be able to point out each other's faults in that way. You know, of course, you're not saying, because we've never killed anybody, it couldn't be real serious, right? So they're just little scratches on the ego that can seem really immense.
Yes.
You know, but we would do it kind of to show him that it was okay, because I find it, especially now in this country, it's very difficult to even have a wrong answer. It's like we're all expected to do everything perfect. And so it's really hard to take any criticism,
yeah,
you know, at all. Yeah. So I think kind of there's also being able to expose yourself in a way that's humorous too, because in the end, you know, most of us probably have not done things that are so serious.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, humor is a great tool in the Bodhisattva toolbox, I think. Yeah, but not sarcasm towards another person.
Right. No, this
not
was
every kind of humor.
Yeah, this is kind of at our own expense.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, not at somebody else's expense.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if it's just private to us, like, we can go there, like, see it in a humorous light, like, oh well, there goes my reputation. Oh well. That was already broken as the author of How to Be Sick.
Yeah.
Anybody else have anything? Patrick, did you have your hand up? No. Yes, every gesture, like every movement is like a little bit dangerous. Suddenly you get singled out. All right, well, I recommend thinking about this verse. Maybe use the contemplations to sort of delve deeply into this, because if we don't, if we just like let it be this week's lesson and then we're on to the next thing, when the thing happens to us, it's going to be really hard to dredge it up. As I can tell you, as I talked about last my experience at the monastery when this whole thing came down earlier this year, I really did not have the 37 practices like right at the top of my head. And if I had, I think it would have been really helpful. So again, as I said last week, I don't think I did too badly, but I really would have benefited if I had really remembered in the moment, like how to deal with the things that were flying at me. So, all right, well, that's verse 15. So we have a few minutes left to talk about how we're gonna proceed. I think we have a decision based on my feelings and all the input that I've gotten from everybody is to take a break, let our minds refresh and get our holiday stuff done and so forth. So, did somebody say something? So the question is, when do we want to start up again? And one person had the suggestion, because they're going to be away the first week of January, that we start the second week of January. And that's fine with me. That's like 7 weeks. That's an extra week beyond probably what we would have picked, but it's fine with me. So that would be January 11th to start again. Is that any objections? Marilyn and Patrick, are y'all going to be around January 11th?
Well, if we're lucky enough, wherever we are, we've got our computer and stuff, yeah. But as far as we know, we're going to be here.
Yes, we all hope we'll still be alive. I hope I'll be alive. okay, so January 11th, we'll start again. So that gives us 7 weeks filled with holidays. But, you know, we already have this time slot carved out, so you could use that. You know, we're not getting together as a group, but you could say set aside an hour on Thursday afternoon.
We can use it during the holiday.
What, Richard?
So we can use it during the holidays. We can practice it.
Yes, I think many people will get a lot of
with our family, yeah.
And I know you have a lot of experience there. Yes, that's really a good point. The holidays are the time when a lot of our emotional reactivity will be activated. Our buttons will be pushed. Or we will be tempted to push somebody else's buttons. And remember that we are bodhisattvas. Really good point, Richard. Thank you. So there will be a lot to work with. I really recommend, as always, again and again, like review. Like, this would be a great time to go back and reread the commentary. You know, we got 7 weeks. You could skim through like those. That's like 2 chapters a week to review. You could review online the class notes, which probably takes a little less time. Do the contemplation. Like, really go into it, really refresh it. What are the preliminaries? Work on your memorization if you're memorizing. And I'm behind on that. I realized, like, I was reciting them the other day in the park, and I'd been in Texas, I'd been busy. I hadn't really been doing it on a daily basis, and I realized, I don't know. Like, I'm lost at verse 12. I can't remember how it goes. Like, all the Bodhisattva boot camp verses I don't have, so now I have to learn those. yes, Anne.
Well, this is an aside, but I heard this wonderful talk today. Some fellow wrote a book, it was on Point on the radio, and he is working with the human genome stuff, and he said how the greater the database becomes, the more we related we all are scientifically microbial, and that he has found that it makes a difference in the way people treat each other. And so if he says that somebody is his 10th cousin, the 5 times removed, suddenly they're nicer to him. That's called the mother factor or the family factor, that if you think someone's related to you, you react with more compassion toward them.
Wow. That's like a modern restatement of dependence, right?
Yes, and the thing of, think of everyone as your mother. Well, they scientifically, it's true.
Yes. Yeah.
Nice to hear.
That's great. Always good to hear these things scientifically.
Yeah.
It is. Any validation. Yes, yeah. Angela.
Also, it's been helping me to remind myself that I have the 6 perfections. So when I lose my patience, I say, I have unlimited patience. When I start to get crazy, I start to, I'm sorry, I have unlimited patience, and just really address that. I have unlimited generosity. So it reminds me of that. For some reason, that helps me a lot too.
Yes, I can see that.
Someone told me, like one of the lamas down here, Lama Karma, was saying, you don't trust your Buddha nature. And that really kind of got to me. I don't trust the Buddhas. I don't trust myself. And so that was somewhere I could help myself and go, I can trust myself to do that. Because I like live in fear of Thanksgiving, honestly. So, but I usually lose it with my sisters, and I don't see them often, maybe a couple of times a year, and we stay stuck in these patterns. And it's so easy to do with strangers and friends, and then with them, it's like, okay, this is the truest test I can have, that being able to know that I can trust myself, that it's always there, that it's just my attention span is going, that it just helps me to do that.
Yeah, well, 2 things. One is, that's great. You don't trust your Buddha nature, or you could trust your Buddha nature. I think that's great. And to remember that you have all these unlimited qualities, your Buddha nature has those. And please say hi to Lama Karma for me if you see him.
I will. I'll see him tonight. We're having a board meeting. So.
Oh, great. Let's have a good board meeting. The other thing, though, I want to point out the flip side of that, which we don't want to get caught in, is like expecting yourself to have unlimited patience in any given situation. Like, we're going to fail the test quite frequently, and it's okay, because our Buddha nature can absorb that. You know, we're still in training. So we don't want to be down on ourselves because we didn't react the quote right way, unquote, in a difficult situation. You lose it at Thanksgiving, well, you lost it. And if you want to, you could go through those 4 steps, recognize and regret, resolve never to do it again, even if you know you will, remember the refuges, and remediate it. You could apologize, or, you know, smooth it over in some way, or do some purification mantras. But don't carry guilt because you failed the Bodhisattva test, because we all do it every day. I do it at least 3 times every day, like in a big way. So
I like a little small things though every day, because it kind of builds up momentum for the big things. I think you have learned from Mingo Rinpoche too. And it's like, do it in small ways. So when I start to lose my patience with my daughter and her homework, it's like I have an infinite patience. So hopefully that'll build up to help me not react as much.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Pema Chodron, we've talked about this before. Pema Chodron talks about getting hooked. Like, we want to keep an eye out for the things that hook us. And I added the corollary, like, catch it at the snag. When you start to feel snagged, like, that's when you walk away. You count to 10, you take a walk, you generate loving kindness in your heart. You take a moment when you start to feel snagged, and then it doesn't turn into a whole hook, and you don't, like, lose it in a big way. I'm working on that frontier, catch it at the snag. Okay, anybody else before we do our prayers? All right, then we're going to dedicate the merit. I'll mute everybody so we don't have a train wreck. Their screen, that's not the right thing. Oops. Their screen. I don't want to share the screen. So many steps for every little thing. Okay, we're ready to do our dedication of merit now. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntuzam Poent Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication, please fulfill. We're going to let our attention sink again from all this study and conversation into vivid awareness of our body, stable on our seat, straight and relaxed, vividly alive in this present moment of awareness, completely open to all sensory input, all thoughts, just not getting hooked by any of them. Okay. So I'm going to unmute people again, and if anybody wants to hang around and chat for 5 minutes or so, I'm good. I don't have to go right away, and if not, we'll just end our meeting.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays.
You too.
Hi, Deidre.
Hi, Namdak. Good to see you.
Long time no see.